I don't know what to say.
Well, then don't say anything. I just tried it your way, and it was a big mistake.
Hello, everybody. This is Again With This Melrose Place. Today's episode is Season 4, Episode 20, Pause for Drug Joke, No Lifeguard on Duty. And now, here are your hosts, Tara Ariano and the Fug Girls, Jessica Morgan and Heather Cox.
Hello. Welcome back for this huge episode.
Oh, my God.
Thank you. Double episode. Double the Fugs.
Exactly. That's right.
People were very complimentary about your first appearance on.
They were. Oh, absolutely.
Oh, thank you. Oh, God. I'm sure we'll find a way to disappoint them.
Before we get into this one, wanted to remind you, again with this, our Patreon episode number 72 is dropping November 12th. We are finally doing it. Let's watch Christine Elise in Season 6, Episode 21 of Law & Order Special Victims Unit, Blood. Sarah will be back for this one to lead the discussion. I have not watched it yet. Very excited. You can get that and all of our previous Patreon episodes at patreon.com/againwiththis. And as I indicated, No Lifeguard on Duty is a double episode, so get comfy. It's gonna take a while. It's so long, in fact, that we do have an E-plot, as we discussed in the last episode. And guess whose
Matt?
It is? It sure is Matt.
Oh, Matt. Really, when he popped up at like minute 24, I was like, oh, him again, yes.
I really feel like the writers let us all down by not finding a way to make him progressively lower in the alphabet as the season progressed. As the year or the series progressed.
Like, yeah.
He should have been a Z-plot at one
point. Poor Matt.
Emotionally, he's always the Z-plot.
It's true. And there's so many characters that you feel like it could almost happen. Like, they just keep adding more and more. I mean, I know some leave, but it just seems
like let's give Lisa, Rinna, and Jamie Luner something to do rather than Matt. Bump him down the alphabet.
Well, let's get into it. It's ultimatum time for Matt and Alan. And at the hospital, David, the gay social worker we met last week, invites Matt on a group friend hang to a dance-a-thon. They never explain what this is. And I assume in the original script, it was like, it's an AIDS fundraiser.
I know what it is.
Oh, do you? Please tell.
Yeah. They call it the APLA dance-a-thon, and that's AIDS Project LA. And they did used to have a dance-a-thon in the 90s to raise money for like AIDS Project LA.
But they never say that in the episode.
No.
And I wonder if someone was like, can Matt do something that's not AIDS related? Like,
I know.
But we all figured it out, especially you. So well done. And Matt says he's already going with Alan, he hopes. And David asks if things are okay with Alan and Matt. And reluctantly, Matt tells David about Alan's horny straight soap character. And David's response is all over the map. Clip 2.
Must be kind of hard to watch.
No kidding.
Look, Matt, if it's unsettling for you, think how it must be for Alan. You know what can happen when a gay person tries to fit in both worlds?
Well, that's a little unfair. I mean, he's an actor. He's just doing his job.
Is he? Or is it a red flag about his sexuality? Matt, a lot of people are sexually ambiguous. Personally, I couldn't handle that in a relationship, but that's just me. Gotta go.
Okay. First of all, he's like, you know, it must be hard for Alan, which is one position. And then one sentence later is like, but are you sure he's really gay? And if he's not, what's the big deal? Like, people are bisexual and they were in the 90s as well.
Yes.
Right? What's with the bisexual cancellation here, dude? It's not fair. My note said, does this dipshit not understand acting?
Right.
Totally. And which is funny because I actually wrote something similar last week about Matt and forgot to say it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like all of a sudden here, Matt's like, well, he's an actor. It's his job. I'm like, where was that attitude last week when you were losing your mind over the fact that he had to, like, I don't know what he was doing, like suction his face to another woman's.
Yes.
I will say, I think Doug Savant, although he gets nothing to do, is like really kind of good and natural in this part.
Mm-hmm.
And like he makes this conversation seem normal.
Yeah.
When you look at his face. But then like just now when you hear the audio, you are like, wait.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
He's a brilliant actor on mute.
Yes. The other great thing about this scene, and you can see this in the visual aids, is that after David walks away, Matt is in front of like a whiteboard of like doctors and patients and stuff. And one of the doctors is named Dr. Defenestrate, which if you're not familiar with this antique term, means throw out a window. Like that's not a person's name.
The one above him was also something.
It was Dr. Like DeMonico.
Dr. DeMonico.
But not DelMonico. It's Demon. Echo.
Yes. And I looked at that and I was like, did this air on Halloween? Like, what's happening? Is it Halloween at the hospital?
There's also a Dr. Heidelberg spelled H-Y-D-E. So yeah. I'm looking at the visual aid. I'm not just like a photographic memory. And that's like a Jekyll Hyde reference, right? I don't know.
At this point, I need to trump all of that with my real world doctor sighting when old man Cole had to go to the urologist. And I'm shit you not, 100% true. I can prove it if I need to. One of the doctors was Dr. Richard Chop.
Oh, no. Oh, my God. Wow.
You've got to be really good at your job to get away with, for to people to come to you when that is your name. Uh-huh. He must be not only the best name, but the best urologist. <It's
true. laughs> Or the best lawyers.
Right.
Dr. Defenestrate, working in the burn unit, I see.
So that night at Montezino's, Alan apologizes to Matt for his self-absorption lately. And Matt, in his formal dinner pullover chenille sweater, keeping it real sexy, complains about Alan picking a restaurant too dark for Matt to even read the menu. Alan doesn't want to fight, so he says they can leave. But Matt is sorry for being testy. But when you love someone, you want everyone to know. And apparently this is the first time the L word has been spoken between them, which Alan notes. And Matt does not walk it back. And Alan brazenly places his hand on Matt's. And Matt reminds him they're in public. But Alan doesn't care because he loves Matt, too. And Matt just stares at him like there's no smile. It's completely a blank face in return. So do you love him or do you not? What is happening?
Matt is such a moody bitch, which is what I'm like. He just like nothing is right for him.
Yeah.
These two actors do not have chemistry.
They
either.
Don't. The guy who plays Alan is terrible.
He's not really bad. I think the guy who plays the guy at the hospital is also kind of bad.
Yeah, I agree. And neither of them is, in my opinion, very cute. Certainly not.
Very smarmy looking.
Not in Doug Savant's league, because Doug Savant is very good looking.
Yes, very, very good looking. He could do better. You could do better, Matt.
Mm-hmm. So some number of days later, a teamster, I assume, prevents Matt from entering his apartment because Alan is in there getting interviewed on tape. And Matt shoves his way in to hear Alan being a big Hollywood phony in clip 3.
A couple weeks ago, I couldn't rub two dimes together. But now I have this nice apartment, job security. But that is, of course, if the fans like me.
I just came home to get a book.
Oh, so is this your roommate?
Yeah. Yeah, but back to how my life's changed.
Right. Well, tell me this. Are you in a relationship currently?
No. As a matter of fact, I'm single and loving it.
Okay, so... Matt leaves and they have a fight about this. And I wonder if at this point Alan has a bank account yet, because a few episodes ago he didn't, or so he told Matt. But his representation of like, I have this nice apartment, like, dude, you are
also like, how do you, was Matt working a night shift at med school or something? Like, how do you get a whole camera crew to Matt's apartment? Matt doesn't know about it. Like,
right.
Matt's just coming home to it. I don't know. But for a guy who is so paranoid about being caught out. For his sexuality, he's so obvious about it. This is the second episode in a row where he hasn't known how to handle other people, and it's like, he's my roommate.
Yeah.
And then like awkward facial expressions. And you're like, also, you're an actor. Like,
right.
I think I probably said that last week too. Like, fake. Can you not
act like
better?
A straight person? Yeah. He also like gestures with his head for like Matt to leave. Like, you are on camera. Like, they are capturing this. But I also love that the interviewer is clearly also coded gay and completely knows what's happening. But
I just logistically, what kind of dum-dum doesn't tell the person they're living with, oh, guess what? They're filming an interview with me today at like 9. So just FYI, like take your shower early. Like this isn't just like you're trying to keep this a secret, but what are you talking about? Like, yeah. This doesn't make any sense. Even under the most like banal circumstances, you'd mm-hmm. be like, heads up, like 44 people from E are going to be here today at 6.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the same dum-dum, yeah, who would sit there and be like, now I'm set for life if the fans like me, I guess. And you're right. Like, well, you're tempting fate. Also, they don't like you. I don't know who your fans are, but they don't. Fans of that show do not like Alan.
I guarantee they don't. And yeah, you're so right. Like, this isn't an interview that would have arisen like on an hour's notice. Like, they would have at least told you it's happening tomorrow, you know. Dumb. Anyway, when we pick back up with these two, Alan's been sleeping on the couch. He whines at Matt that he doesn't want to move out. And after a very fake apology, he pouts that the two things he wanted most in his life happened at the same time. Clip four.
Let me see. Your career is one. What's the other one?
That is not fair.
You know what? Maybe not. But you know what? I have worked damn hard to earn the respect of my friends, my colleagues, even my father. And I will be damned if I'm going to go back in the closet to accommodate anyone, you know, especially my lover.
Look, I never asked you to do that.
Fine. Then come with me to the dance-a-thon.
You know, I'm not sure what my schedule is.
You're not sure about much, are you?
When I was watching this scene, I did think, like, very sincerely to myself, I found myself thinking, these two are just not in the same life place.
No.
Like, they're not right for each other.
They're not. Like, just break up, I mean, is always the answer.
What are you doing?
Yeah.
He's not there yet, Matt. It's sad for you, but, like, this isn't going to work.
Yes, yeah. But Alan is also being very disingenuous, being like, I never told you to be closeted. Like, well, if I'm dating you and you're closeted, then, you know.
Yeah. Alan sucks. Yeah. Don't get me wrong. But they're also just like, this isn't going to work.
No.
Yeah. At this point, I did not know what the dance-a-thon was. So I thought to myself, has ever a phrase struck my heart colder than come with me to the dance-a-thon? Which, no. But also, again, Matt has to go from zero to let's go out in public and like sexy dance together.
Right.
Like, really? Like, you really think he's going to say yes to that?
Well.
Spoiler.
Stand by, because then it's the dance-a-thon. David runs into Matt outside waiting for Alan, who shows up just after David volunteers to be Matt's dance partner. And Matt makes introductions. Alan is cold and possessive. And when David's gone in, Alan murmurs that David is definitely into Matt. But Matt says it doesn't matter. Matt's there with Alan and they get pap just as they're hugging. So, of course, that is what their next / final scene in this episode is about. Alan's agent got a copy of the photo faxed to him before its publication in a tabloid. Like, not how tabloids work.
Especially not for, like, soap opera actors who are brand new on their show.
Like, right.
Even in the heyday of soaps, that wasn't happening.
No, he's a nobody. But Matt is like, you look good. What's the problem? And Alan is like, the problem is I am trying to pretend I am straight. Please keep up. I'm paraphrasing. Matt is like, who cares? And Alan says, the networks called him in for a meeting that afternoon, so they probably do. And Matt says, Alan can sue if he gets fired over it like Matt did, which, sure, but also no. Like, they'll just come up with another reason why they fired you, A, and B, like, is this the reputation you want to get when you're brand new in your acting career in 1996? No. But anyway, Matt says Alan's fans can't be any more homophobic than Alan himself is, and that's where we leave it with them.
Zing.
It's
finally
a lot.
Dumbass.
Just break up.
I can't even remember if that stretched over both episodes or just the one. Just the one, the first half, right? Was it across both episodes?
Yeah, it did. Oh. Barely.
I always think of it as like, I know it's a 2-hour episode, but I always think of it of like, how would they have split it in half if E was running a marathon? Like, there must be a demarcation line.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just couldn't like, figure out. Oh, what a terrible. I also enjoyed when Alan was like, the tabloids are going to run it with like soap star, whatever his name is, with his unidentified gay lover. And I was like, I don't think that's what photo captions, that's also not how photo captions work. Like,
no.
Alan hasn't lived in the world at all.
Yeah.
Like, they don't run around saying, look, it's this man and his unidentified gay lover.
No, they would say mystery man, if anything. That's
exactly
that tabloid talk.
Yes. Which is mystery man. Or like, I mean, I guess for women, they usually use gal pal, but I'm sure there's like a boy version of that or
right.
a man version. Let me be correct. Yeah, this kind of fell apart for me with the tabloid part. Like, obviously, this whole plot line's not really holding together that well. The thing that's funny to me about it is, not to get meta, You guys are on a TV show.
Right.
So you know how TV shows work. So why does the TV show in this TV show not work like a TV show?
Yeah.
Just for plot. I get it.
Like, this is always the case with TV shows on TV shows, by the way. Like, they never work the way they should. Unreal, this is something we bitched about with that all the time.
Oh, yeah.
Like, this is not how a dating show works. Like, they're not dropping episodes while the season is still filming. They're just
Heather
not.
And I had, like, very ranty IMs about Unreal, which obviously I love the first season, but, like, as two people who used to work on reality TV, we were like, this is not how you shoot a reality program.
Right? I'm having that right now. I'm otherwise enjoying The Big Leap.
I even knew you were going to say that.
But, like, they appear to be shooting the show at the production office, and everyone in the show is wandering in and out of the production offices and, like, past storyboards and monitors.
We don't do that.
So like,
no. You're not allowed to do that. You do not get to come into the office.
You sure don't. But what would have made this plotline work better, maybe, is if Alan were already famous. Like, if they had met, you know, under whatever circumstances. Like, they could have still met at the hospital, which is how they did meet. But if Alan were more, like, famous, it would make
like
more sense.
He's like a famous soap opera hottie, and he has thousands of fans who want to bang him, women fans.
Yes.
That makes total sense. And then he has, like, an actual, like, work reason to feel hesitant about being gay. Like, what about all these women? This is, like, keeping me employed. That's, like, a legitimate conversation.
Or he's, like, a former big-time soap opera actor hottie who's down on his luck and trying to claw his way back up. And that way he can still live with Matt and be broke. Yeah. And he's still interesting to the E or whatever that network was supposed to be doing a true Hollywood Alan.
It just seems like they didn't know what to do with this guy from the start, because like a couple of episodes ago, they just established the one where he said he didn't have a bank account. They were like, he was very vague about where he'd lived before. And then finally was like, oh, I was like a kept man for this guy, this rich guy.
Mm. Yeah.
And then that's never come up again. Like,
I know Melrose kind of dined out on having an openly gay character, and they were like, look how progressive and representative we are, but they always shoot themselves in the foot by appearing to put the least amount of time and care and effort into those stories.
Yes.
So what are you left with? Like, are you really honoring the community that you're purporting to represent? I think no.
Well, and also just from like a storytelling perspective, X used to be a kept man and boyfriend used to be a kept man and boyfriend is a soap star. Those are two juicy stories that shouldn't be the same person.
Yes.
You could have, like, it's a soap opera. He's going to have another love interest. Like, save kept man for later.
Seriously. All right. Well, I think we've wrung all the juice we can out of our E plot. So let's move on to our D plot. Richard and Joe take aim at Jane again. This is the episode where we find out Jake has had a garage this whole time that's like adjacent to the complex. We've never seen it before. Apparently it's empty as we see it the first time. It's perfectly suited to working on motorcycles. So why was he always working on his bike next to the fucking pool?
That's my question.
I guess because Joe's BMW was parked in there?
Yes.
He wants to get some sun. He's working on his tan.
It's also incredibly, like, clean and neat for a garage.
It's
like,
so
there's
clean.
He's clearly never worked on his bike in there. There's no, like, oil spills. There's no rags anywhere.
The floor
there's,
is
like, a
pristine.
Surfboard in the corner.
Yes. But, like, Jake, to me, makes sense as a neat freak. Like, he's very neat. His shirt is always totally unwrinkled. He's
always
got his shirt tucked in.
Yeah.
Like, I can believe that he keeps a very clean garage.
But we've also seen that surfboard in his apartment.
Like, really?
Yes.
There's one. Does he have two? And why not keep them both in their garage? Well, it's established in 90210 when we first meet him that he taught Dylan how to surf.
Oh,
and how to pick up girls. That's in their, like, first scene.
That makes sense. Yeah, he doesn't read as a surfer at all. He is not going down to the beach to meet Dylan McKay anymore, which is a mistake.
This is not a surfer show, for sure.
It's not. Anyway.
This is a show about, like, people at pumping gas in LA. If you go by the main credits, it's a show about people walking in denim, standing at a newsstand, and using a corded phone.
The point is, the garage has to suddenly exist to be a point of conflict. Jane wants to use it as the location for her new design business, LOL. She at least offers to pay him rent and let him keep parking his bike there, but he doesn't park his bike there. Joe parks her car, which at some point she got. And when we see it, it's a BMW, as Heather said. Jane claims she would not want to infringe on that arrangement, but Jake would like to bone Jane, so suddenly Joe's use of the garage is not that official, and he will talk to her about it, as long as Jane stops pretending they didn't kiss the other night. she wasn't sure that it wasn't just an I'm happy you can walk again kiss. You know, that kiss that we've all had at one point or another. But they seal their new arrangement with more kissing, which he clarifies is, and I wanted to kiss you kiss. And the next day, Jake shows up at Joe's place before work to tell her she can't use the garage anymore. She seems fine with this when she thinks that Jake has bought a car himself, but he explains that's not the case and adds that Joe should not read into it. Just be honest. You're kissing willingly. Tell her the truth. She's obviously going to figure it out. But Joe remembers that the two of them slept together for 6 months before Jake offered her the garage, and he just exits the conversation, which is when Richard and his real obvious spray tan come out in a towel to get the latest. Can we talk about the spray tan? Because
he's
what the hell?
He's so tan. I wrote on my notes, why are you so tan? It's hilarious.
It also appears to only be the front half of him that is that tan, because his back doesn't look it matches.
No.
He has like a Ross Geller, I don't understand the spray tan machine experience.
But you can see in the visual aids, there's like a tiny crease on his stomach that's like white. So like he bent in some weird way when they were spraying him, if he was, you know, standing up. Who's to say? This is obviously early spray tan technology. But they discuss it. Clip 5.
You offer Jane half of your business, and then Jake tells me she's getting the garage to set up shop.
What's she gonna design? Spark plug belts?
I don't know, but I just hope that Jake isn't gonna get taken advantage of.
Well, forget about them. You take advantage of me.
I don't know.
Gross.
I'm gonna get something smeared all over me. I'm on my way to work. So she does. He notes that he's not safe in a towel around her since Hawaii. Nice callback, by the way. Proving that the writers remember things that happen, but she pulls it off him and they go at it, I guess. Some number of days later, Jane is setting up her studio as much as she can around Joe's car when Joe herself shows up to take it to work, making sure Jane knows that Joe doesn't buy Jane's Susie Homemaker ad the way Jake does. Not sure what homemaking has to do with any of this. It's not like she's trying to set up a Martha Stewart business. Like, what? But I guess I did learn sewing in home ec. I didn't. I got a pity D. Moving on. Jane knows what Joe and Richard think of her, but she's done manipulating people. She's just trying to rebuild her business. And Joe thinks that with Jane's karmic debt, she shouldn't plan on success. And Jane warns Joe there's no design talent left at Richard's company, and all Joe has to offer is her ability to fuck him. I'm paraphrasing. Not much. And Jake hears the end of this as Joe departs, leaving Jake to scold Jane. Clip 6.
Just so you know, she gave up this garage without any notice.
Look, Jake, I know how it might have sounded, but she provoked me. She does it every chance she can get. Obviously, she's bothered by our friendship.
Somehow, I don't think that's it. I gotta go to work.
Are we gonna get together later?
I gotta work late.
Just get back together with Joe. This is what everyone wants to happen. Stop wasting everyone's time. Ugh!
Oh, we're just treading water here. This is Jake's garage. Jake's garage had all this stuff in it. Where is Jake now keeping the stuff he was keeping in his garage that Jane has taken out of the garage? So I know the visual aids get me thinking about all the like dumb logistical stuff.
Yeah.
But it's true. Like, does he have another garage?
It feels very Los Angeles to me that this like lover's triangle is hinging on a parking space.
On a parking space. <I know>.
Like specifically Melrose parking, there is a bitch. Yeah, like you want a spot. I get it.
Yeah,
I live in the burbs, so I can park wherever I want. But if you live in that neighborhood, it's a pain in the ass.
It's a very nice garage. It's like
it
a
is.
Cottage.
It's big. Yeah,
you could rent that as like a studio apartment.
Oh, totally. I assumed that she had just put his stuff to one side.
I'm sure she
was going to be spreading out. But anyway.
This also reminds me that I hate Jane.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Jane's terrible.
Push her back in the ocean, Sydney. She's the worst.
So an unknown period of time later, Jane is sketching in the now car-free garage when Richard comes by. This is where I first noticed that he got his hair cut for this episode. It's still bad, but it's better. And he says she's not going to impress many buyers with the setup. However, I guess he really did always like her designs because he gets curious about the sketches that are spread out around her. And they have this exchange, clip 7.
Is your new line?
Yeah, and I don't think I want to be sharing it with the competition.
You think that I would steal them?
I know you would.
So it's come to this, huh? Reduced to a couple of ruthless competitors?
Exactly.
Well, let me tell you something. Your only opportunity at success was the one that I gave you.
You want to talk about opportunities? You have been writing backs your whole career, first Mackenzie's and then mine. Open your eyes, Richard. There are no more backs to write.
Thank you for reminding me how vile you can be. I came down here to wish you luck, but you can forget it, because you're finished in this industry, and I'm going to personally see to it.
Oh, no.
Oh, darn.
I'm so invested in this business fight between the two of these idiots. Really.
It's a design fight. She gets me every time.
Ridiculous. So over to the real studio where Richard is making everyone work until 9 p.m.
What?
Can you imagine? Everyone gasps in horror. I was typing these notes at 12:09 a.m., by the way. Is that because I laid around in bed playing ball sort watercolor puzzle until afternoon? Don't worry about it. But yes, I'm always like amused by the work hours on this show where people are leaving the office when it's still light out. Like, maybe it's just
They're
how work
so
has
lucky.
Changed since then. But like, no.
I just think in the fashion industry, surely it was never that unusual to be like, you are going to stay until at least 9. I think most people would be like, cool, I can leave at 9.
Seriously. When they have a show or something coming up to make this like bind, they just sold a success. Whatever.
Yeah.
Despite this hellacious, unprecedented deadline, Richard took time out to get a new sign made without Jane's name on it, which they're hanging during the scene. But he's also losing Joe's support, possibly because she's still working on the coffee table in reception, which we've complained about before. She follows him into his office to bitch that work is ruining their relationship and lives. But he says all that matters is getting the line out, in which case Joe quits and he stops her, which why just hire a freelancer like every other fashion company, and asks what else he should do to make her happy. And she says this bullshit, clip 8.
I don't know. More. Just jump in the pool with your clothes on, you know? Sing me a love song. Say I love you in French. Just prove to me you're still alive.
It's not me. I can't do that.
And I can't do this.
You're adults. Like, this is such a TV problem. Like, no one cares that much about those dumb gestures that are meaningless.
No. And did Jake do any of that stuff, really? Do we think Jake was popping in and being like, Shatim, Joe, or whatever?
No.
Like, there's no way.
And I get that we're not supposed to be on Richard's side, but sometimes people have to work. Like,
I know.
Sorry.
And the thing is, I kind of am. It's very sobering when you realize that you're on Patrick Muldoon's side here. But, like, This came out of nowhere, I felt like.
Yes.
All of a sudden, he's like, today we're busy. And she's like, we don't have a love life anymore. And I'm like, at some point, he's like, we just did it this morning, like spontaneously with the towel. And that's kind of what I thought. I was like,
yeah,
this makes no sense.
No. Anyway.
You have 25 episodes. Can you arc it?
Seriously. So at Shooters that night, we join Joe as she's just finished complaining about this to Jake and telling him that she quit. And he notes that you shouldn't leave one thing before you have another one lined up. Unclear whether he means the job or the boyfriend, but this is not advice Joe wants to hear in either case, judging by the way she glares at him. And Jane walks in just then, saying she hopes there are no hard feelings about the garage. And Joe snits that she hopes Jane and her new landlord will be very happy, and then stomps out. And Jane tries to make small talk about Joe, which Jake does not engage with. And she knows that Jake has been avoiding her, which he denies. But when he goes back to his office, she follows and puts her arms around him, telling him not to play games. She knows he wants her as much as she wants him. He's just letting gossip get in the way. And he shakes her off, saying her career ambition is not a good match for his lifestyle, which this is somewhat consistent, given that he and Joe broke up in part because he was complaining about her working long hours all the time. But Jane denies that she's only about work, trying to convince him with a kiss that ends in a string of spit between their mouths, which I'm sorry. You can see it in the visual aids because I noticed it. I couldn't unsee it. But he insists that they're friends who helped each other and don't need to take it further. But Jane is just as insistent that they should take it all the way. And he doesn't fight her as she kisses him again. And I assume they fuck, or we're supposed to think that they did.
I mean, I assumed they did after they made out in the pool. So this whole episode was a surprise to me.
I was
who
like,
knows?
Bang
the part
the
where
pool?
She wrapped her legs around his
What's
waist
happening?
And he was running his hand up her butt. I was like, well, that's going to end.
Right.
With the fucking.
Well, maybe not. So then we're at the complex where Joe returns in time to see Richard standing at the edge of the pool, fully dressed, and then pointedly fall back into the water. and this outfit, which is just like jeans, t-shirt, cardigan, and the shorter hair, is the cutest he's ever looked, because I'm Gen X and this worked on me. Sorry. Mm-hmm. Like, it's better than his dumb double-breasted purple suits. But then he tells her in French that he loves her very much. And she didn't think that he would actually do this in the middle of winter, but he couldn't afford not to take her literally. They make up. No one cares. This is not a good plot line. He's bad.
No. No one cares about these two.
Mm-mm. No. You could tell Joe would have broken up with me, because when he fell into the pool, I was like, his wallet!
Yes.
I'm not romantic enough for you, Joe. I'm sorry.
Maybe you left it in the car. Maybe you thought ahead. Yeah. Yeah, it's in the days before you could be like, no, his phone! But
I know.
All right, moving on to our C-plot. You're literally never going to guess what brings Michael and Kimberly back together.
Oh my God, this plot line.
I know. Kimberly returns to her office to find Michael there waiting for her. She is not interested in chatting, so he reads her messages to her because she never turned on her phone mail. It's not how voicemail works. It did not work that way at the time either. You don't turn it on or off. But anyway, here are her messages. Clip 9.
Cynthia Cohen called. She wants a session. Your gynecologist called.
It's very good timing getting back on the pill.
Keep in your pants. It's not going to happen.
And some guy named Vic called. He said you know what it was about.
What? Did he say where he was calling from?
Oh, down, girl. Don't tell me I have competition.
I mean, in that you're both jerks, I guess you're competition for one another. But tell us more about this Cynthia Cohen who has been convinced to... get treatment from Kimberly. We never find out. So Kimberly has to explain who Vic is for the new viewers. He was a stalker who held her in his creepy dead apartment, and then she had to escape by lightly tugging at the silk scarves he had tied her with. Anyway, when Michael realizes Kimberly's actually freaked out that Vic may be coming after her, he suggests that she move into the beach house so he can stay with her around the clock, but she would rather take her chances with Vic. And when we see her next... she's meeting Vic in jail to tell him to stop wasting his phone privileges. I don't know, maybe don't give any oxygen to him. That might help. Just,
there are choices, Kimberly.
As a psychiatrist and a stalker herself, Kimberly should know better.
She should. So he says he had no one else to call and that she promised to help him, which she did, by the way. She said she would treat him, if I recall correctly, and then never did.
Kimberly.
But then she testified against him, which we never saw. That happened off screen because it had to happen off screen so that we couldn't see someone trying to, discredit her testimony by being like, aren't you also... facing pending murder charges. But she claims she helped him by getting him off the streets. He does not agree with this interpretation. She should be grateful because if not for the glass, he would hurt her the way that she hurt him. And he thinks about her all the time. One day he's going to come for her. But she says he'll have to get out of there first. And that won't happen until he's very old. But he's going to think about her constantly until then. And so she leaves and he yells at her. And you can see in the GIF and the visual aids, even the other inmates are like, settle down, bro. It's very funny. Vic is too extra, so even good. For the extras. So some number of days later, Michael finds Kimberly at work. His cop friend told him Vic got 15 years with no possibility of parole. And she's already on her way out, very relieved when Michael extracts a thank you from her, offering to take her out to toast Vic's incarceration. Classy. Kimberly repeats that she doesn't trust Michael and definitely doesn't want to date him. And when he asks what it'll take for her to change that, she tells him, a miracle. Oh, Kimberly, don't bait a Catholic. He's going to try and get one going.
Don't bait a Catholic is a t-shirt, by the way.
That's true. Also, absolutely. We all know this is real.
Sometime later, a nurse tells Michael that Vic was accidentally released from jail. What?
Wow. I have notes.
And everyone's super chill about it.
Yeah.
And like, I think that wasn't the nurse who told him, or she was like, oh, you know, you're that guy. Clerical error or something.
Just
like,
one of those things.
It happened.
Like, this makes no sense.
How is this not on the news?
Yeah.
I mean, my question is, and this might come up later and I just don't remember it, or it's like in the back of my head. I was like, did Michael bribe the cops to let this guy out of jail so he can, spoiler, save Kimberly from him?
No.
Because that's in character for him, though.
True.
He would do that. And she also would do that to him. As I yelped about last week, the fact that we're supposed to be like finding Kimberly really sympathetic is wild to me. Like,
yeah.
obviously, I love her as a character. I think she is an amazing television character.
Yes.
She's not sympathetic. She just blew up a building that has been completely, I guess, rebuilt to look aged. Another question I have later.
Well, you know.
We'll get to it, but there's all these scenes of people like opening the door at Melrose Place. I'm like, that door is from 1927. Did you rebuild this blown up building with like vintage doors? I got into a whole like dark hole.
But, wow. Like, I never even thought of that.
But it's crazy. It doesn't look new.
Yes.
But like, why are we, let's not pretend Kimberly herself is not a sociopath.
Right.
That's all I have to say.
But that's this entire season depends on you forgetting what happened 20 episodes ago.
Yes. Which, you know, we have long memories, you guys. Like, how can you? She's one of the greatest TV sociopaths ever. It's going to take more than 20 episodes to make us forget that.
Absolutely.
And also, she testified against this guy. He stalked her, but she didn't stick around to see what his sentencing was.
Right.
And Michael had to, like, call his cop friend to find out what it was. That doesn't seem.
Yeah.
Feels like you'd know, like, oh yeah, that guy who stalked me got 15 years.
You would think. So Michael then races to Kimberly's office to warn her, finds it locked. A janitor says she just left. Cut to the parking lot where Kimberly in her short skirt and tall boots are walking to her car. Seems like it's already unlocked as she makes a quizzical face putting the key in. And sure enough, Victor is in the backseat with a knife, a real one this time, not a little shitty switchblade like he had when he was actually holding her hostage. But he told her they would see each other again. He tells her to drive and she's pulling out just as Michael comes running out the door and sees what's happening. And then commandeers a car from a flower delivery guy so that he can give chase. Somehow this works. Like, isn't your own car here? But anyway, he pulls up beside them, tries to ram them off the road. Eventually, Michael drives into the back of a truck. Kimberly loses control and hits a propane tank, which starts hissing. Michael drags Kimberly out of the car and gets her away just ahead of the car exploding with, as far as we can tell, Vic inside. And Michael covering Kimberly's whole body with his, as much of it as he can. He's short. She's tall. Is one of the hottest moments yet. Sorry. It worked on me.
No, I'm for them to be sociopaths together. Let's not get that twisted.
And it ends with Kimberly and Michael silhouetted in front of the explosion, which is very cinematic. Someone was very proud of that shot. And I have go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to go on. Unless there's more to say about this ridiculousness.
No, I was just going to say that, like, I have more logistical notes, which is, where is this hospital where you can leave it, I guess, during the day if a florist is, I mean, like, day, it's dark out, but like working hours, if a florist is making deliveries and there is no traffic anywhere, so you can have a car chase and also then somehow end up in like a deserted lot where there's a propane tank.
Yeah.
They went all the way to Bakersfield, you guys.
Yes.
Really,
in like real life, if someone is trying to stalk you out of quote unquote Wilshire Memorial, wherever I feel like that would be, you would all be sitting in bumper to bumper traffic. Like,
yes,
this is why there's no one on the street. There's suddenly an empty lot full of gas. Like, this just, I was like, I want to know where this hospital is supposed to be.
Even if you granted that it's like they ended up at that weird oil derrick that's like right beside a Target, you know, the one I'm talking about, Best Buy. I want to say it's on La Brea, maybe. It's right by where we used to live.
Isn't there one in like Century City too, by a school or something?
Well, there's oil derricks all over LA, but like not a giant propane tank.
No, it's true.
You are in bumper to bumper to get to said oil derrick. Like, again, I get it. Like, you want to have a car chase. I'm going to give you a little creative license. But I was like, wow, what time is it? Because there's no one on the road.
Yeah.
It's the same reason that they should have done but didn't. Like four episodes of 24 where they kept checking in with Jack and he's like, I'm on the 405. Still on the 405. Never getting off the 405.
Tara, aren't you thinking of, maybe I'm wrong, but isn't there one at a school near us? Wasn't there one kind of on a school ground somewhere?
No, there's one like right beside that complex at Santa Monica where the Target that we used to go to that was right near our maybe it was a cement factory or something. I don't remember.
There is one at a school. The one at the school is at Century City, right?
Maybe.
No. You guys are thinking of the cement factory across from the Target. Yes, that's a cement factory.
Okay.
Beverly Hills High School has an oil derrick.
It's the one that's painted, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And everyone's always
It's like you never even lived in L.A., Tara.
Sorry. I don't remember where the derricks are.
All of the NIMBYs in Beverly Hills don't want the subway to go through there because they don't want like people who would take the subway to be in their neighborhood.
Right.
But their excuse for this is one of the subway makes the oil derrick blow up.
I remember this now. Yeah.
I don't think that's what's going to happen. And also the city was like...
It's like you never watched La Brea, Jessica.
Yeah. Well, it's true. I haven't. Oh, my God.
Or Volcano. Well, you just never know what's underneath.
That's true. That's a good point. Fair enough.
So after the commercials, Kimberly wakes up in a hospital bed with Michael smiling over her, alarming. She only has a concussion, and she suspects there's something that he's not telling her since, you know, there's precedent for that. But he promises that she's fine, and she'll probably get out tomorrow. When she asks about Vic, Michael says he'll never bother her again. Okay, say he is dead. Like, this is a soap. We need the facts. And even him saying he's dead doesn't necessarily mean he's dead, as we know. But she guesses...
I just couldn't figure out why she was in the hospital. Like, they said she had a concussion, but...
Yeah.
I guess maybe she, off camera, before he covered her with his body, she hit the ground really hard. All right, I'll allow it.
Maybe. I mean, Alan was in the hospital for like multiple days and he just broke his wrist. So they're very conscious at Wilshire Memorial of not getting sued for inadequate care, I guess.
And I guess she does have a gigantic head scar. So she has a past. Maybe they want to check her head.
They
may. I was going to say they should take her wig off, and then I realized her hair grew back.
Sadly, she should get to take that wig off dramatically every season.
Always.
She really should. So Kimberly guesses she should be sorry to hear about Vic, but Michael says he was going to kill her, and they have this exchange, clip 10.
At one point, I looked into his eyes, see what he was going to do next. And all I saw was hate looking back at me. Like I was everyone and no one. And then I turned and... I saw you.
It was like a sick flashback, wasn't it? I thought... God, I'm going to lose her again. And then I realized it was fate. Chance to right the wrong I did to you the first accident. So, maybe now we're even.
Thanks for saving my life.
Okay. I'm glad that he finally got around to, like, I caused the accident that gave you that huge scar on your head, because there was a lot of passive voice prior to that point. But even so, they were maybe even when she tried to blow him up. So now he's ahead.
Also, she was driving. When did she take a beat to stop and look deep in his eyes to see what he might do next? Like, no wonder you hit the propane tank, Kimberly.
So the next day, Michael and Kimberly flirt as he feeds her Jell-O. He notes that he has been there a whole hour without her telling him to leave, and she regrets how hard she's been on him. Clip 11.
I think it's taken more energy to hate you than it would have been to just accept you the way you are.
I'll admit, I really just clipped that for soundboard posterity, because we'll probably get used to some of that in the future. But now Kimberly's prepared to be Michael's friend. He wonders if that includes sex. For her, it does not. But then he starts kissing her hand and she makes him stop, but not very forcefully. And that night, they're playing Dirty Scrabble on the bed at the beach house. And after Pet, Lick, Wonder Bra, because it's 1996, Michael spells love as in he loves Kimberly and she loves him. And she empties her rack. Not a euphemism. That's what actually happens. Tells him he wins and pounces on him and they fall off the bed together and it's cute. Sorry.
I mean, who isn't shipping these two sociopaths?
Right.
You're wrong if you're not. I do too.
But Kimberly, you can't use up all your letters on Wonder Bra. It's a 9-letter word.
I knew Heather
only
was going to have
seven
this
tiles.
Note.
Yes. I'm sorry. I'm a Scrabble purist. And I actually gamed it out. I'm like, maybe Michael played Bra and then she played Wonder on top of it. But like, though.
Yeah.
Michael would play bra, though.
That he was
very in character for Michael.
I feel like maybe I worked through my issue with that, but like just so we're clear, can't use up all your tiles on a 9-letter word.
It's true.
You can't have 9 tiles.
No. All right, on to our B plot. Peter embroils Sydney in his Bobby issues.
Oh my God.
You will recall, we left Bobby and Amanda in their hotel room being held at gunpoint by Bobby's father, Vince, who would still like to know whether Bobby is going to have Vince shoot Amanda or Bobby himself. And Bobby calmly says, not her. And Amanda won't let Bobby sacrifice himself. She shrugs off her goon and steps to Vince in Bobby's defense. And Vince never knew Jack, who, on top of all his other failings that we know about, couldn't wait for Vincent to die so that Jack could take over the business. He told Amanda 100 times how much he hated him, but Vincent cannot hear any of this. Jack didn't take off for his own selfish reasons like Bobby did. And please go to the visual aids to see just a small selection of the silent movie faces that David Grohe makes in this scene. Because, again, playing to the 5th or 6th balcony, very big performance. He says he should kill Amanda just for uttering these lies. But then Bobby gets up and stands directly in front of the gun, daring Vincent to shoot him in exchange for Amanda's freedom. And Vincent starts really leaning in on the capital F family shit in clip 12.
You've got no honor. You've got no loyalty. You've got no respect. You never did.
I've always loved you, Dad.
I don't want to say the mob stuff is an overreach for this show, but I never understood why they have these accents and they're supposed to be from Miami. Like, none of the three of them, the Parisis that we meet, have the same accent for starters.
Oh my God. Yeah, you're right. That's pretty egregious in the great Melrose Placeian kind of way. Especially, and I know we talked about this last week, that they're also doing this whole thing in the Bellage or whatever nice hotel they're in.
Yes.
Where clearly he's either not going to shoot either one of them, or he's not going to only just shoot one of them and then leave the other one to call like the concierge. We're like, someone just murdered other person.
Can you
in
send
my room?
Up some towels, please?
Nobody seems that concerned. Like, I'm like, that's how you got out of this, is because no one's really going to murder someone in this hotel room today.
It's true. So once the gun is like a 1/2 inch from Bobby's throat, Vincent backs down, but keeps it real dramatic after like a 4-minute pause. Clip 13.
I'm not your father. I got no sons. My sons are dead. You killed them.
Got it!
Seriously.
Get it out, man. So then the other blonde goon is like, oh, we're going? Bye. Thanks for hosting, Mrs. Woodward. Like, has no lines, just like wanders out. And Amanda hugs Bobby, now an orphan, although it seems like his life's going to be a lot simpler now. And that was not actually very hard to get out of.
No, that was my surprise. Like, as I said last week, I was like, how's Amanda going to get out of this one? And
yeah,
I did not expect her to get out of it by just like saying a couple lines and standing there. Like, I thought there was going to be more to that.
Yeah.
You're wearing those high-heeled mules, Amanda. You got to use them for something.
That's right.
Love a man.
So back at Bobby's, Amanda tries to get him to talk. He knows that to earn Vincent's respect, he sometimes have to stand up to him. But then enter Alicia. They have problems. Vincent is selling his shares in the cable company. Oh, no. If he does it before Bobby comes up with $200 million, Bobby will lose control of the company. The only dumber plot line than everything to do with Richard's design business, by the way. No one cares about Bobby's cable company at all.
No.
Aaron Spelling always veers into like the business minutiae. And the show goes way in the weeds when that happens. Like every show. It happened on Dynasty too. And like that was a show about oil barons. And when they talked about oil, you were like, ugh.
Don't care.
Shut up about buying these oil lines, Alexis. Get back to your two husbands in the poison paint.
Throw a drink. Yeah.
So Alicia's so frustrated that she turns to Amanda for clarity on what could possibly make Vincent do this to his son all of a sudden. Amanda's like, shrug. And then Peter walks into Alicia's office trying to find out whether she's been canceling on him because of problems with Bobby's business or because Alicia's actually seeing Bobby. But she says she's not Bobby's type. Before Amanda, he only dated redheads. Note that. Then she gets buzzed that Bobby's on his way and advises Peter to leave since Bobby probably wouldn't want her mixing business with pleasure, and Peter is fine with that. Clip 14.
We can keep things en plein air.
Okay, I clipped that because a couple of episodes ago, there's a scene where Alan, the shitty actor, refers to his liaison dangereuse, but he, like, I can't even pronounce it as bad as he did. And he's supposed to be an actor. Like, I know they're shooting this episode, like, on the fly, basically, but give him a second chance. Like, someone give him a line reading if he doesn't know French. So I was just impressed that Jack Wagner nailed the French accent on that.
I feel like someone at Melrose Place writing staff was learning French. Point, because, like, there's like Joe is demanding that Patrick Muldoon, like, yep. Frenchy French her into bed, and meanwhile Peter's just like Antoine, like,
I know,
snoozes out of him.
It's a good theory. So Alicia tells him to go out the back. He does not go far, staying by the door to eavesdrop so that he can hear Bobby say he wants to make a donation to the hospital. Alicia says he isn't in a position to do that, but he's not going to take it back, even if his business is going down. This is the same donation from a few episodes ago. It's like, finally, they're like, hey, can we get that money you said you're going to give us? So he has to. So that night, Amanda returns to Bobby's, where he was very unnaturally lying in front of the fire alone, which you can see in the visual aids. It's a lot of drama for a man on his own. Anyway.
He's an orphan, though, Tara.
That's true.
So. Also, Aaron Spelling loves people laying in front of fires. It is one of his tropes. He will put you in front of a fire 100% of the time.
So Amanda's there to hand off records of all of her financial assets and holdings. He should take it to buy back some of his father's shares. But he says it's not enough. Plus, he won't take her money. But he is touched that she offered. And if he's got her, he's got everything he needs. And she ends up lying in front of him on the couch with his arms around her. It's very romance novel cover, as you can see in the visual aids. So then Sydney goes to see Peter in his office. He's full of compliments for her new 20Z bob that she's gotten. I'm curious about your thoughts. Oh, how do you feel about this new hair? Because
I have a lot
I'm
of
not wild
about
it.
What's happening with Sydney right now? First of all, watching this did remind me that during this period of the 90s, there was like a real sort of like Hitchcock 50s style that I was deeply invested in and did a lot of. This haircut is a bridge too far. Her little flip last week, super cute.
Mm-hmm.
You can do whatever you want with that. This is so layered, and it's growing this out is going to be a nightmare, Sydney. What have you done to yourself? You look insane.
It's so wiggy. It's like, it's too styled. Like, it just looks like it's perched perfectly on her head, and it's made of like foam rubber or something.
Yeah.
I mean, it is in character that Sydney would do something like incredibly costumey with her look.
Especially this, like, season, because she's been doing a lot of vintage styles for sure.
But you look insane. This is a bridge too far for me.
Agree. Heather, your thoughts?
I mean, Jessica said it all. It's terrible. She looks insane. But it's like every person, like all of us who have made the mistakes of the 80s, 90s hair, the fact that like we all went to like, oh my God, growing that out is going to be a nightmare.
Yeah.
Because it's like, we've done it.
It's true. We know.
But the crazy thing is, I do think like this 90s hair, not her, but a lot of it is coming back, because I'm looking at some of these women and I'm thinking, oh my God, like that blowout looks amazing and bouncy. Like Allison's hair, her bangs have some problems, but looks pretty good. Obviously, Kristen Davis has amazing hair and it's looked like that forever. So
still
that's
does,
classic.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But even like Joe's kind of quasi Rachel haircut, I'm looking at and I'm thinking, that's cute. Like she looks cute in that.
She does.
It's a real testament to how good Laura Layton is, though, that she can basically act through all of this.
It's
and
true.
Kind of, and still carry all of her scenes. Mm-hmm. And
she's so good. She's
it
so,
just sort of
such a
tracks.
Pleasure.
Yeah, she just
she's
sort of
fun.
She makes sense of the insensible. It's good.
It's true. And with that bone structure, which she still has, like you could do a lot, but this is really testing the limits of her powers, I would say, this haircut.
Yes.
Yeah. She looks like one of those like old sitcom housewives that got time traveled into the 90s. Like, I feel like there was a sitcom like that on Nickelodeon. It was called like Honey, I'm Home or something.
Yeah.
And it was
Sydney Vision.
Yeah, it's exactly what that is. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Vision. Which, incidentally, I would watch.
Mm-hmm. Same, for sure. She is basically a witch. Like, it's not that big of a stretch.
Yeah.
She's a Scarlet Witch.
Yes. Exactly. She's the original Scarlet Witch.
There we go.
Anyway, back to the scene. So Peter has an opportunity for Sydney to earn some extra cash hitting on Bobby. So that red headline from Alicia earlier was not just a non sequitur. And they had this exchange, clip 15.
Are you saying you want me to sleep with him?
No, Sydney. You wouldn't have to go that far. But if you did, you'd be compensated.
What makes you think I would sleep with someone for money? Anymore, anyway.
Perfect. No notes. Love her.
I love it. Also, I'm staring at the visual aids again, which are so inspiring. And like, Jack Wagner has the same haircut as Jane right now.
Yeah.
And it's really distracting. Why does he have Jane's haircut? Looks better on Jane. He needs...
Also because in this period of the 90s, most men with Jack Wagner's hair would have put some gel on and like swooshed the front of it up.
Yeah.
And he's like, is he trying to do like a Clooney sort of Caesar, but not really?
I think his Caesar is still coming. But before he had the Richard hair, it was like very floppy, right. Hugh Grant.
Yeah. Jack, right. Like Jack Wagner General Hospital hair.
Yeah, yeah. The floppy, yeah. Jack Wagner hair. Yeah. That's how he looks now in my head.
Now it's Jane's hair. You're right. Not really sure why.
Anyway, Peter blows past that to his terms sheet, clip 16.
First base is a grand. Second base, two. Third base, three. Get the picture?
Yes. And I'm insulted. But out of curiosity, what's in it for you?
Bobby has a soft spot for redheads. I have one for Amanda. Oh.
Okay, back to this baseball stuff. Seems to me a homer ought to pay a lot more than a base hit. Say, $7,500 if he slides across my plate. Deal?
Deal.
I'm not mad at the two of them in this pairing either. They are fun.
No. Yeah, this is fun. Like, they're both great. Obviously, Sydney is, like, amazing.
Yeah.
And even Peter is... I find Peter to be kind of a drip sometimes. Mm-hmm. He's very entertaining in this plot line, I think.
Yes. Like, he's like half evil. It's good.
Yeah, who cares about the cable stuff? But, like, all of his other machinations are very entertaining.
Absolutely. So when Peter adds that there's a hospital fundraiser the next day that Bobby and Amanda will attend, she also negotiates a new dress. Not bad. So Amanda's watching TV in her adorable paisley pajamas, which you can see in the visual aids. And if you know where I can buy them, please tell me because they're really cute. When Bobby comes by, he has nearly cobbled together enough money to keep control of the company away from his dad. But Amanda's assets would put him over the top. He hates asking for heteronormative reasons, but also because he could lose it and then they would both be fucked and she would blame him. But Amanda reminds him that he was the one who said if they have each other, they have everything. He says he'll make it up to her and he smooches her cheek and then heads out again for more businessing. Buddy, at least kiss her mouth. She just gave you all her money.
Seriously. I don't know.
But that's
Amanda.
The end of it. So the next day.
Seemed like a good plan.
Oh, no.
It seems very out of character for her in a way, like to especially to let him leave and be like, yeah. Great. Oh, thanks. Gotta go. And I feel like the real Amanda Woodward would be like, screw that.
Right.
I at least should get something out of this. Slide across my plate at least, sir.
So the next day, Peter runs into Amanda out shopping for a fundraiser gown. This shit looks like a wedding dress. It is wintertime. Obviously, it's in the visual aids. It's not good. She should always be in black. She's a blonde. This does not suit her, in my opinion.
I agree.
I'm with you. My first thought was, oh, is she trying on like wedding dresses? Like,
yeah.
That's what I thought Peter was going to walk into.
There's a plot reason for it to not be black.
That is true. So
yes, it's true.
He asks about Bobby's cable business. She lies that it's great. And after she's moved along, ignoring his compliment, Peter asks a sales clerk to get him that dress in a size 2. And then it's the fundraiser. Bobby's horny for Amanda in her hot dress, which she apparently paid a fortune for. Honey, that is a David's bridal job at best. She's raiding a canapé tray when Peter walks in with Sydney, who is in the same bad dress. And she is not happy when she spots Amanda, telling him the embarrassment will cost him an extra $1,000. And you know what? Fair.
Yeah.
And there's a shot of the two of the white dresses standing next to each other, both of them looking pissed off in the visual aids, which was very funny to me.
It's good. It's Aaron Spelling loves an identical dress moment.
Hey,
Brenda
Dad.
Kelly 2.0.
So Peter walks Sydney over and Amanda immediately starts yelling at him for copying her. And he responds by negging her, clip 17.
Well, it's not like it's the most flattering style on you. And I had no idea you were going to buy the dress.
What are the odds?
Why don't I get you a drink?
Thank you. Come to think of it, I'm pretty thirsty too. If bringing that little idiot was an attempt to make me jealous, it didn't work.
I think your ego is getting the best of you, Amanda.
Let's get one thing straight. I don't care who you date or how you dress her. Just don't turn her into a carbon copy of me.
Also fair. Sydney's irritation, very funny. And Amanda stomps off right past Alicia, who comments that she didn't know that Peter and Amanda were acquainted. He calls them old friends, to which Alicia's like, it didn't look that way. And Sydney finds Bobby at the bar and asks him to order her a pink lady. And I looked it up. This is gin, grenadine, and one egg white. Oh,
I looked it up too. God. No one is whipping up a pink lady behind the bar at a fundraiser.
No, you don't have an egg white.
No, he doesn't have an egg white back there.
But he does with appropriate disgust. And they have this exchange, clip 18.
So, you're still working for Peter?
Yeah. I mean, no. I mean, yeah.
Well, he must be paying you pretty well. But Amanda tells me that's a very expensive dress you have on.
You want to know a secret? I'm returning it in the morning. It's kind of a poor girl's rental. Oh, is it just me or is it really hot in here?
Yes, right. Yes. Okay, there you go, sir.
There's a terrace out on the left.
Terraces were meant for two.
Look, I'm not interested. Now, show with your personality, you can find somebody else to play with.
Terraces are meant for two is the title of my autobiography, by the way. This is more gracious than Sydney probably deserves, but I think that Bobby gets she's just doing what she can in the gig economy like the rest of us. And that's when Amanda rolls up and asks Bobby to excuse them. Clip 19.
Nice dress. This old thing? I don't know what you're up to, but Bobby's off limits. Feeling a little insecure, Amanda?
Oh, spills a red wine on Sydney.
Just a little clumsy.
You totally did that on purpose.
Oh, Sydney, you can put on an expensive dress, get your hair done, clip on some earrings. Bottom line, you're still a $2 hooker. You just have a new pimp.
Can I have a towel, please?
I don't think a towel's going to help.
Sydney had like 30 seconds and a drink called a pink lady and she didn't retaliate? Like, yeah. You grabbed, I kept thinking that the name of the drink was the smoking gun and that she would grab the pink lady and like fire back. And then we would have had an absolute spectacle.
Oh, man.
Stained white dresses. But no.
Well, that is Sydney, a missed opportunity.
I think it's because Sydney is honestly no match for Amanda Woodward.
Like, yeah.
As charming as Sydney is, and I do love her, her schemes generally do go down in flames.
Yes.
So
I feel like human nature would be like, what? Grab what's nearby, throw it right back. Maybe
yeah.
Not. Maybe I'm someone you shouldn't invite to your parties.
I'm going to remember this next time. Next time I throw a drink on you.
I'm easily provoked.
Yeah, you're right. That is a huge missed opportunity. But I also buy that Sydney is just so freaked out that like, I'm going to have to return this $300 dress or however expensive, right. Very
to
expensive.
ABS ones. Alan Schwartz.
Oh, I'm going to have to send this back to Azos. So the next morning, Peter in his waxed chest calls Sydney from his hotel room to see what he owes her and is shocked to hear that she didn't even get to first with Bobby. And then Alicia enters and Peter covers and hangs up. She guesses he was talking to Amanda. And when he denies it, she continues pumping him for information about their former relationship. And he downplays how serious it was. And Alicia warns him that he better not have any ulterior motives for sleeping with Alicia herself. But his motive is pure lust. And so is hers, apparently, as she throws him down on the bed. And you know he likes it like that. So good job. Sydney's next move is to bring her cable box to Bobby's desk and flirt at him to fix it. It doesn't work, perhaps because of her hair bow, which is, I'm sorry to say, back. And you can see in the visual aids. And he reminds her that he made his situation clear, but she heard his family is connected. And she does the thing with like making her nose crooked, which is like such an old, old reference I'd forgotten. That was like sign language for mobbed up. But
I didn't know what it meant. I had to watch the scene to be like, oh, that's what she's doing.
Right?
Like, I just was like, what?
But she says she loves that Godfather stuff. Is he an Al Pacino or a James Caan? And he comes around the desk to grab her by the scruff of her neck and direct her to the door. Big escalation from an arm grab, which is what we normally get on this show. And she apologizes. Nice guys like him make her nervous, and the nice ones are always taken. And when she goes on her way, Bobby comes back into his office chuckling, and it's honestly not clear to me if, like, that was John Enos laughing at Laura Layton or if that was, like, Bobby laughing at Sydney. Either way, I buy it because she is ridiculous and very funny.
Laura Layton is very funny in this role. Mm-hmm. And even though this plotline is objectively ridiculous, she really does kind of sell it. And I think you kind of get, oh, yeah, I can see why Peter was like, I bet she could seduce him. Because you see it, you're like, I feel like I could sort of see this playing out. Like, she really sells it.
Yeah. He's also such a big glute that you sort of think he's not going to be smart enough to see through it. But he did.
Yes. And half of it is I can't even tell how much of it she's lousy at and how much of it is a tactic to be like, to make him laugh at her and make him be affectionate with. Like, I can't really tell. Obviously, it's not going to work either way. But, like, if it was ever going to work, Sydney would be the one.
Yeah.
She charms her way everywhere.
It's true. So at the office the next day, Peter fires Sydney from the sexpionage. And when she protests, he accuses her of liking Bobby, but she claims she just likes the challenge. He doesn't believe her, jealously raging about what Bobby's appeal even is. And her defense of Bobby seems to prove Peter right. She says he's the kind of guy who makes a woman like Sydney want to change her ways. Okay. And if she wants to pursue him, Peter says she's going to have to do it off the clock. And he also wants the dress back. But she admits it got ruined in the line of duty because I guess he never saw her again at the party after she got spilled on. But when he insists, Sydney says Amanda was right to choose Bobby over a meanie like Peter, which meanie is the best word you can come up with. Weird. Speaking of Amanda, in the very next scene, we see her rolling into Bobby's office to find Alicia in there alone, sorting through papers on his desk. And to Amanda's insinuation, Alicia assures her that their relationship is purely professional, but she can see why Amanda might feel insecure, given Bobby's reputation as a heartbreaker. And Amanda admits he's not the type she usually goes for. Her last boyfriend was a surgeon who was as slick with his words as he was with a scalpel, and she's not sure she ever understood his motives. That's how it is when you date someone after they tried to murder you, I guess. We haven't forgotten that either. And as Amanda leaves, Alicia hopes things work out between Amanda and Bobby, since he seems ready to settle down, in Alicia's opinion. And the next day, Bobby returns from a run to see Sydney in his driveway. She thought he should know there's a certain someone who wants Amanda and Bobby to break up. And he's like, yeah, duh. And she tells him about the scheme and that she's out. And he asks if Peter replaced her with someone else, but she doesn't know. And then Bobby walks in on Alicia reapplying her lipstick and guesses she has a new boyfriend. She was uncomfortable saying it before, but it's Peter. And he says Peter's a good man, but she's going to have to cancel their dinner at Eclipse that night. There's a meeting in Palm Springs he needs her to take. And she grabs that she had better call Peter then, but Bobby says he's responsible, so he'll do it. And for some reason, she believes Bobby that he will.
Why did he cancel? He's going to cancel her date for her.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous.
Call your own boyfriend, lady. What are you doing?
That doesn't make any sense on any level.
Yeah. And if she's been paying attention, she knows that Bobby and Peter don't get along. Like, why would you assume that he would actually do it?
And she knows Peter was Amanda's, like, last serious boyfriend because they just went through that whole thing.
Yeah. But then we're over at Eclipse, where Bobby appears to let Peter know Alicia's not coming. And if Peter wants to mess with Bobby, he should do it directly. Clip 20.
Go around the back way. You're going to have some trouble.
Kiss! Just kidding. There is no vibe between these two. This is the straightest that any two men have ever been. Bobby orders Peter to stop seeing Alicia, and Peter's like, how about no? And then at Bobby's place, Amanda's working on a MacBook with the screen folded all the way down. You can see this in the visual aids. It's like, I get that you've been an actor since you were a kid. You've never used a computer in your life, but that's not how they work.
No. Surely one of the 70 people on set thought to themselves, I don't think she can actually see what she's typing.
No. And then when she's actually typing, it's like even worse because I made a GIF to show like how inept Heather Locklear is at typing. A common problem.
She's really bad
actors.
At it. I will say that she is not as bad as Jennifer Love Hewitt, who is the all-time worst TV typist, because she just like tickles her fingers across the keys at warp speed and never uses a spacebar ever. And like, I'm always like, why don't you just direct your actress to just type their name over and over again? Because you have to use the spacebar to type your name. Just type your name.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's a homage Jennifer Love Hewitt,
the queen.
Monistic manuscripts when they didn't actually use spaces. That's all it is. You just don't understand.
That's true.
She's operating on a level that I could never reach. That's obvious.
Alicia on her call, she thought he would want to report on her meeting in Palm Springs where Bobby definitely was not. So now Amanda knows that that happened. So then Bobby comes back. He's evasive about where he was. And when Amanda gently presses, he claims to have been in Palm Springs all afternoon, and Amanda's face falls. And she now knows because of Alicia's call, that's not the truth, Ellen. And when he asks if he got any messages, she lies back that he didn't. So that's where we leave it. Cracks are starting to show with this beautiful love story that we're supposed to believe in, I guess.
Who could have predicted?
Yeah. Finally, our A plot. Brooke loses everything, but she's still got Allison somehow for a while.
Allison.
After a much longer than usual opening B-roll, because it's a double episode and they have to fill the time, we are at the Beverly Hilton, where Brooke and her workout clothes are brusquely telling a desk clerk her key card isn't working. Surprise, her credit card has been declined. Billy already cut her off, which is fucking cold, A, and really putting her at risk for her physical safety. This was also a plot point in Run, if anyone remembers that show last year with Merritt Weaver and Donald Gleason.
Oh, where, yeah.
Where her husband, played by Rich Sommer, patron saint of shitty husbands, did that her. And, like, you can't do that even if you're fighting. Like, people need credit cards to live.
Also, do they really just cancel your room key?
Yeah, I doubt it.
I guess if it's a hotel and you're racking up that big of a bill, they would maybe bill you incrementally. But I was the whole idea that they would, her room key suddenly would stop working and they would have to look up why. Wouldn't they just be like, we're going to escort you up to your room. You can get your belongings and you're
going to go. Of course. Like,
it makes no sense at all.
Right.
I read in a story about a con artist in New York who was bilking her hotel out of hundreds of thousands of dollars. They escorted her to her room and then kicked her out with all her junk.
Yeah.
I guess the writers of Melrose Place have just never been staying in an expensive hotel and had their ex-husband cancel their credit cards on them before.
Billy is being such a dick. I just have to say this before we really get into this.
He really is.
I can't tell who we're supposed to root for in this storyline.
Yeah.
Like, who do the writers think is the hero of the storyline?
I mean, I think...
I feel bad for Brooke.
Yes, me too. And they just keep, like, I mean, chipping away at her over the course of this until the inevitable end, but we'll get to it.
Billy the Brandon Walsh of the show?
Yes.
He was, but I think even at this point, they're starting to be like, no, he actually is kind of shitty. Like, people are telling him a lot. I mean, mostly Allison, but Brandon never got that treatment.
That's a good point.
No, it's true.
I mean, I noticed watching this, Billy is still wearing his wedding ring. If you're cutting off her credit card, take off your freaking wedding ring, you asshole. I hate Billy right now.
Agree. I mean, I've been hating him.
He's just accessorizing Jessica.
She's wearing her ring too, but that makes sense.
Yes.
But like, he is being such a douche about like, we're broken up and we're not married anymore, blah, blah, blah. Well, then take off your ring, dickhead.
Yeah. He was hitting on Allison in the last episode.
Yeah.
Anyway, obviously, Brooke goes straight to Billy at his desk to ask, what the fuck? He is unrepentant. She reminds him that he forced her to cut up all her dad's credit cards when they got married so Billy could feel like they were independent, which, no offense, but I don't think those would be much use if you still had them anyway, just saying. He reminds her that she's still getting an income from D&D somehow. Plus, she still has the $10,000 from her trust fund, but he knows she spent it on the non-refundable down payment on their house. Where is this house?
What?
1951?
Exactly what I said. I was like, you know where I am in my life where I heard that you made a $10,000 down payment on a house in LA? And I was like, what?
Yeah.
Where?
Yeah.
Well, a shed? Like,
Jake's garage? Maybe.
What? Yes.
What happened to this house? Did they sell it?
They canceled it.
Where? Oh, okay.
I think. But she couldn't get the money back.
Yes.
Oh, that's a mess.
She lost it. Maybe she said down payment, she meant deposit. Because a $10,000 deposit, could happen.
That makes sense. Okay, anyway. We figured out this real estate conundrum.
Otherwise, she was living under a manhole.
Seriously. So Billy's answer to that is she should have talked to him before buying a house, which, I mean, she should.
That's
but
fair.
Brooke calls him a heartless bastard, and he smirks because that's his only face. And Allison hears the end of this and comes over to scold Billy. He thinks he's only being half as cruel to Brooke as she was to him. She's a survivor. She will figure shit out, he claims. And when we see Brooke again, she's getting more bad news. Her checking account is overdrawn. And then it's time for a meeting. So she takes off her athleisure jacket and tries to sneak in wearing her sports bra and leggings with some random coat on top. Not even clear if it's hers. And Amanda snittily reminds her that D&D has a strict dress code. She explains that her choices were to be casual at work or not come in at all. But the latter might have been better since her toy client has been calling Amanda to snitch on Brooke's lack of attention. And Brooke tries this. Clip 21.
Billy is the primary on that account. I was only doing what I was told to do. Of course, he's not a very good caregiver at home. Why would it be any different at work?
Cut it out.
But I'll call Mr. Lindy and I'll explain to him how difficult it was for me to concentrate on his account after Billy threw me out of our house and served me with divorce papers.
Why don't you just tell him the truth that you were too busy faking pregnancies and suicides to worry about work?
I wasn't faking anything. Why are you so mean to me?
Sorry, I shouldn't have said that. It was unprofessional.
She wasn't faking anything. She legitimately thought she was pregnant.
Billy
she faked
sucks.
A miscarriage. That was true, but yeah.
Details.
Again, they pull out of this meeting and there's like two other random D&D employees who are just like talking to each other. And I'm like, are you not listening to this? Because I would be taking notes.
I feel like they were saying to each other, like, can you believe what a douche Billy has turned into? Yeah. I know, right? Yeah. Remember when he was like a carpet shop owner or whatever the hell he was in the first season?
Furniture. Yeah.
Thank you.
He's
all
emotionally
right.
abusive.
Yes.
He's so mean to her.
It's terrible. So Brooke leaves. Amanda suggests that they all reconvene after lunch so everyone can recover. And when everyone else is gone, Amanda gently asks if Billy is okay instead of yelling at him for bringing his shit to the office. And he declares that he can't work with Brooke. Thank God Amanda remembers he was the one who demanded that Amanda hire Brooke back. And he just smirks because, again, only face. And Amanda should do whatever she thinks is best for the office. So this guy thinks he's important enough to be laying ultimatums on his boss. Okay. So then when we see Amanda next, she's in the office in an ankle-length wrap dress. It is so unsettling not to see her legs.
I had the same reaction. I was like, what has happened here? I feel weird.
Is she okay? Yes. Does she have a chill? Anyway, Brooke is not there yet. Amanda very professionally tells Allison that if Brooke doesn't get there in the next 5 minutes, Amanda will have to wait to fire her until after lunch. Clip 22.
Fire her? Why would she do? You were at the staff meeting. She all but turned the conference room into a bad version of divorce court, and I will not tolerate that kind of behavior.
Come on, Amanda. You know Brooke's been going through a tough time.
We all have unseen pressures, guns pointed at our heads. Not all of us let it affect our work.
Look, what if I were to get involved? Act as a liaison between Billy and Brooke. Pick up the slack if necessary.
Is this some newfound maternal instinct? I mean, Allison, you were only her stepmother for 10 minutes.
I have to believe that somewhere in Brooke there's a good person. Like her father.
All right. I won't fire her.
Excuse me for interrupting, but since you're still on speaking terms with Billy, maybe you could tell him that he needs to pay our dry cleaning bill. And not to worry, I already picked up my things.
I wouldn't be looking for traces of Haley and that girl, because in her case, the fruit fell a long way from the tree.
Have you ever gone to get your dry cleaning and they let you take it without paying for it? Because that's never happened to me.
Or like, I'll only take half of it.
Right.
Like, you can have the other half as collateral. Like, I don't.
Yeah.
Very strange. Also, like, why is she firing Brooke for being unprofessional in that meeting and not Billy?
That's right. My question. And both of them need to be on a leave of absence is what I would do if I were Amanda Woodward. Get the hell out of here for 3 weeks. Figure out your shit. You're not getting paid. Come back later.
Right. I mean, the reason is she used to fuck Billy and not Brooke.
Yeah.
So that's part of it.
Do we really think Billy is like a great copywriter? Because I don't.
No,
Like, he's not Peggy Olson in there. Like, I'm sure Allison can handle whatever he's doing.
They've never shown, they occasionally, not for a while, but they occasionally show Allison's ideas for campaigns. They never show us any of Billy's ideas. Like, no. Even they know, oh, he can't, Andrew Shue cannot sell this at all. But I also love in that clip where they're like, you know, she's a good person. She, somewhere in there is a good person like Haley. Like, you guys all remember Haley was a white collar criminal who was trying to like flee jurisdiction and, you know, start life over again under assumed identity. Like, yeah. He was not great either. Just saying.
Did he, like, get drunk and die off the side of a boat or something? Like,
yes.
Yeah.
That sounds right. That's very Melrose Place.
He sure did.
Aaron Spelling loves killing people on boats also.
That's true.
He loves killing people, period. I'm telling you, season 4, I believe, is a bloodbath.
Yeah. Well, that's, I mean, Reed died on a boat as well. Joe's ex.
I mean.
Oh, was that? Yes. Yeah.
That's right. Obviously, she we all remember him. Dylan McKay's yes. dad, who of course was not actually dead, but we thought he was dead for a very long time.
That's true. That was in a parking lot next to the, but next That's to true. A boat. It was at the marina adjacent. Though.
I always think it's the boat that blows up, but you're right. He was just boat adjacent when he,
yes.
when he,
no, quote unquote, Palmer died. Was the one who was on the boat when it broke right, up, right, when right, it right. Blew up, Amanda's dad.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, Allison finds Billy at Shooters that night to yell at him about skipping work. He didn't want to be there when Amanda fired Brooke, so she has to be the one to tell him that didn't happen and why. And Billy thinks Allison is just postponing the inevitable. True. And drags her to the floor for a dance. Enter Brooke just in time to see them swaying, laughing, gazing into each other's eyes. And Jake serves Brooke the tequila she ordered, but adds that she shouldn't stay around watching Billy and Allison. She disagrees and then makes the scene we were all expecting, starting by unplugging the jukebox. Clip 23.
Thought I better pull the plug before you two start going at it on the dance floor.
So much for pretending she was dead. Wait here. So I don't know what you hope to accomplish, but I think you should leave.
It's a public place. Or did you lose sight of that gyrating all over the floor with my father's widow?
Why are you doing this? Why are you following me?
Spare me your ego. I don't have to follow you, Campbell. I have plenty of men interested in me. I just have the dignity not to rub them in your face.
Do you mind? Well, let's go.
No, stay! Dance! Drink with all your friends. I've got better things to do with my time and better people to do them with. I can't go on forever. She has to pull herself together.
Yeah, I hope to God she does.
At least enough to pay for a drink. She stiffed me.
I hope to God she does. Okay, oh Bane. What
He's
the fuck?
The worst.
He sucks. The worst. He's also like totally, I don't want to say gaslighting because I think that's overused. It's not totally accurate, but like mm-hmm. he's being purposely obtuse here. She's
yes.
following you because you're being a total dick to her and you guys are in the middle of a massive breakup. That's yeah. what's going on. Don't act like you've been broken up for like a year and she just popped up. And
yeah.
why are you and Allison all over each other at Shooters? This is not that appropriate. Allison needs to get out of this. Don't yeah. get involved, Allison, you nosy Parker.
Ugh, the worst.
She can't help herself.
No, she can't. So while her neighbors all chuckle at Brooke and her pitiful displays, Brooke herself scuttles down the sidewalk crying. And when a guy brushes her and says she's in the way, she stops dead, hugging herself and weeping. And it is sad. Like, they're really bringing her down to rock bottom yeah. in this episode.
Kristen Davis is doing the work, I'm saying.
She is.
She is.
Like, she's getting all this abuse. Billy gets nothing.
Yeah. This is, I mean, spoiler, this is her last episode and she is making, actually, that's not true. She comes back as a ghost, but
right.
this is her next episode. Her last episode is a living character and she is
yes.
making the most of it.
She's really good
also
at
like
this
to
part.
Point out that they gave Billy a line in the scene where he says so much for pretending she was dead.
Yeah.
Earlier in the episode, he makes a comment about how he's sure she'll find a way to stay afloat. I was like, right. oh, guys.
Very subtle. There's a lot of subtle pool yeah. imagery happening in this episode as well.
Yeah.
Poor Brooke.
So the next night, Brooke knocks on Allison's door. Allison called the hotel and heard that Brooke had checked out, and Brooke cheerfully says she moved somewhere cheaper. And Allison is starting to offer her some money when Brooke stops her. She's there to apologize. Clip 24.
It's just that Billy's erratic behavior pushed my buttons.
Billy's erratic behavior?
Yes. First he has a meltdown and throws my clothes out onto the courtyard. And then he blows up at me in the staff meeting for no reason at all.
What about last night? Was he responsible for that too?
You're right. That was my fault. And it won't happen again. I realize that I need to reclaim my life. I don't want you to tell Billy this, but I have a date with Lowell tonight. You remember him, my ex-fiancé?
You're dating? Already?
Yeah. I'm supposed to meet him over at the country club tonight. Could I borrow something dressy?
Brooke, you'd tell me if something was wrong, wouldn't you?
You'd be the first to know.
Okay. Let me see if I can find you a nice dress to wear.
Thanks. Oh, and a nice pair of heels to go with it.
You don't still have your own shoes? Okay.
They're all in a hotel room somewhere.
Yes, that's true. But to be fair, and we talked about this last week too, she's not wrong about Billy giving her mixed signals, because he was like, sure, we can go to therapy. And then before they went, as far as we know, he was like, psych, here's all your shit packed into suitcases, get out.
Yeah. And he's also just deliberately pushing all her buttons. She's not wrong about that. And it makes you think, like, has Allison never observed people before? Like, she's obviously, this is an obvious mental breakdown happening in front of her.
Yeah.
I also think Allison has like a Billy-related blind spot that we've seen throughout the series. Oh,
definitely.
Like, completely. So he'll do douchey shit and she'll just be like, oh, Billy. Like, he is her soft spot. And this is also why she's like being scoldy at Brooke for quote unquote dating. Well, you were just like up on her husband at Shooter. So there's a little bit of a double standard happening here.
100%.
Wouldn't you be relieved if you thought she was trying to move forward and trying to date? And
yes. So apparently the reason Brooke needed to dress up, also in white again, before Memorial Day, just saying, was to sneak into the country club, mooch food from an unattended buffet, and happen to run into Lowell, no longer being played by Patrick Fabian. Now it's the guy named Brian McGovern. He also has floppy Muldoon hair, or like Muldoon used to have. And here's how that meeting goes. Clip 25.
Lowell, how are you? So good to see you.
Brooke, God, I haven't seen you since you got married to, what was his name?
Billy.
Oh,
but it didn't work out. We're divorcing.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Frankly, I'm relieved. We didn't have a tenth of what you and I have in common. You look great. How's your love life?
Well, as it happens, I'm quite single.
What a coincidence. Maybe we could go out to dinner one night. Take in a polo match like the old days.
Now, why would I want to do that?
Well, I just assumed that you would be interested in dating again. I mean, we were engaged.
Brooke, your father's dead, his estate's gone. What would be the point?
Ooh.
Ouch.
Poor Brooke.
It's sad.
I mean, she's being, again, she's been as subtle as Sydney. Like, she needs some lessons on how to approach someone to make it seem like it was happenstance.
Yeah.
But yeah, that burns.
I was sort of thinking she and Sydney should, like, obviously this doesn't happen, but like, they could team up, and I feel like Sydney could kind of get her like situated.
Yeah. If nothing else, Sydney could introduce her to Lauren, her former madam.
Exactly.
Get her a job that actually pays.
I kind of don't know why she didn't. I mean, I do know why, because it's a plot point, but like, you're at the country club, go find a rich old man.
Yes.
Focus.
Yes,
especially if it's the country club that you've been going to. You know there's ones where she's like, ew, that gross old so-and-so who was always looking at me in my swimsuit.
Yes. Go marry that guy, and then he's going to die, and you'll get all his money. Do I have to do everything?
Right.
There are plenty of trees to bark up other than the guy who is almost assuredly going to be a jerk to you because you dumped him for someone else.
Yeah,
and he was.
Yeah. So when Billy gets to his desk the next day, Brooke is waiting to call a truce. She's gonna need to call a truce with the person who works at the desk. Her whole ass is on while she's waiting for him, by the way. But Billy very maturely completely ignores her, pretending to read the paper as she tries to tell him she had no right to act out at Shooters and he can see whoever he wants, including Allison. And Brooke adds that she's seeing her ex-fiancé, so she can't stop Billy seeing his. And this gets Billy's attention. Clip 26.
Lowell?
Does that upset you?
No, it just surprised me. He always seemed more interested in your money than in you.
Well, for your information, Lowell has never gotten over me. I'm the love of his life.
Well, goody for you and goody for him.
I'm only telling you this because I was hoping that you could put your anger aside enough for us to be friends. Or at least have things civil between us enough that you might attend the wedding when it happens. Oh, thank you so much. The dress was a big hit. Oh.
Well, apparently, Brooke is hot and heavy with her old flame. I feel sorry for the poor bastard.
Doesn't it sound more like wishful thinking?
Yeah, doesn't it? Like, in the course of that conversation, it went from we're seeing each other again to the wedding when it happens. Like, come on, guys, pay attention. But you can really tell that Brooke is falling apart at this point because her hair only looks okay. It doesn't look gorgeous like normal. Like, they tried to sort of, you know, dull it, but there was only so much they could do because her hair is great. And Billy's like, whatever, I don't care. And Allison bleats that Brooke deserves his compassion. And that night, Billy stops Brooke on her way out of the office. And as Allison eavesdrops, he allows that he may have been insensitive. He doesn't want to reconcile, but she should have the apartment. And he is, of course, frequently smirking throughout this exchange. Ugh. I guess I don't need to say that. And Brooke, suspicious, snits that he couldn't pay her to live in that rat trap. And in that case, he wants to give her some money. And she's appalled that he, a middle-class runt, thinks that she needs it. Like, I think he knows what your finances are. Again, dad died. All the money was gone. We all were present. But she says the whole time that she was with Billy, she was slumming. And he smirks the hardest he smirked yet. It's basically a full smile as she stomps away from him. And Billy then triumphantly tells Allison he tried it her way and it didn't work. And the next day, Brooke storms in on Amanda and Allison in a meeting to demand her paycheck, which forces Amanda to explain that when you've drawn in advance and used up all your sick days, you do not get a paycheck. And if she wants to make some money, she should go do some work. And that night, Allison's walking to her car in the garage when she sees Brooke in her own car crying. Brooke tries to get rid of her, but Allison wants to know what she can do. Brooke suggests she bring back her father, husband, friends, and clothes from the hotel. And as Allison looks around, she realizes that Brooke has been sleeping in her car and orders her to come home with Allison. And the next morning, Allison chats with Brooke in the kitchen, offering to lend her clothes if she needs them. And Allison's just about to leave when there's a knock at the door, which she asks Brooke to get. It is, of course, Billy, shocked to see Brooke there, and sidesteps her to go yell at Allison about it in the bedroom. Unsurprisingly, he does not care that Brooke was sleeping in her car because of him, calling her an emotional vampire, which, true a little bit. Allison either has to choose Brooke's side or his, and when he opens the bedroom door to leave, he is unsurprised to see Brooke waiting on the other side listening to this whole thing, because obviously. And that night, Allison knocks on Billy's door. He won't let her in before she declares her allegiance. And she guesses he is more comfortable putting someone out in the street than she is. And he smirks. And caught between two emotional vampires, Allison reluctantly promises she'll get Brooke out by the end of the week. Billy will talk to Allison when she's done it. And Allison yelps at him not to make this a test of her feelings for him, as though merely setting the ultimatum did not already do that. Just saying. But Billy says Brooke brought all this heartache on herself and ruined her life in the process. Like, I don't know, dude. It seems like your life is fine. You know, like, whatever he's claiming she did to him is in the past. And he is up at this point and she is down. But Allison says he's right. He's not. And that she should have considered his feelings. Shut up. But before she leaves, he says he can't get through this without her. And of course, as soon as they have hugged and chastely kissed, Brooke wanders by a window at Allison's place and sees them. And so Allison takes off to give Brooke the bad news. Billy gives her his keys in case things get bad. And upstairs, Brooke gets on the couch under a blanket to pretend she has the flu to try and delay the conversation, which works on Allison against her better judgment. Allison, what a sap, as Brooke herself put it. And when she's gone to her room, Brooke hungrily eyes the keys Allison left. And we know they're Billy's because of the soccer ball keychain.
That really made me laugh. I love the keychain. So it's perfect.
Gorgeous detail. For some reason, Brooke waits until the next morning to sneak downstairs, doff her robe and slippers, and slide into bed with Billy, naked. He doesn't even open his eyes, just lets a body climb all over him and kiss him. And guess what? When he realizes what's going on, he's not thrilled. She insists things can be good between them again. She just has to show him. He insists that he still loves her, but he says he doesn't. And as she begs him to hold her, he stomps off. He wants her out of his apartment and out of his life. And upstairs, as Amanda quietly lets herself into Allison's place in a completely insane, like, white, silver, shiny satin suit.
Oh, my God,
suit.
That suit.
Ooh, every wrinkle is like neon flashing at you. Anyway, Brooke is loitering in the bathroom, and from the hall, Allison yells that they were going to talk today, but Brooke is not in a hurry to get evicted and doesn't care about Allison's offer of a hotel room, and this is too much for Amanda, clip 27.
You've got to be kidding.
Is someone else out there?
You have Brooke living with you? Does Billy know about this?
He knows. Everybody knows. Allison knows. She doesn't care. She's about ready to throw me out. And you don't. You won't even pay me my salary.
Get a hold of yourself, Brooke.
Why? So I can go to my lousy job and work for my bitch of a boss?
You are about a heartbeat away from losing your lousy job.
You know, there's something I've always wanted to say to you, Amanda.
Don't say anything you'll regret.
Kiss my ass.
You're fired. Let's go, Allison. We have an early meeting.
Amanda.
Leave her. She's not worth it.
You heard her. I'm not worth it. Your self-pity isn't winning you any friends. Don't worry. You'll be rid of me soon enough. I don't need anyone, Allison. Least of all you.
Ooh. Kiss my ass right to Amanda's face.
Yikes. Don't take on Amanda Woodward, man. No. You're not going to win that.
No.
I thought that Amanda was like, does Billy know that you're living with Allison? And Brooke's response was like, everyone knows. Allison knows. I'm like, yeah, it's her apartment. She invited you.
I was thinking of the scene that, like, I know obviously for this, for some reason, these last few episodes, there's like no intertwining of any of the plots.
Yeah.
But if only Matt's boyfriend, Alan, and Brooke could have met, they're like two people who need roommates. You guys could live together. Yep. Like, this would work out.
Yep. She could be his beard. Yes.
Yes. Perfect. Yes. I solved both of your problems. If only you had run into each other.
It's so isolated that it almost feels timely. Like, it almost feels like COVID era storytelling where they're like, well, we have this pod of actors and this pod of actors, and they're never going to cross.
Yeah.
Like, not even in passing on the stairs.
Totally.
It really always bothers me when the show confuses me. And some of it's because I haven't caught up on the episodes before
right.
But I don't know where Allison and Billy's relationship is right now. And so when they were downstairs and they're like, she's agreeing to his ultimatums, and then she kisses him, and then they cut back and she kisses him like two or three more times, like quickly. I'm like, are you doing it? Like, have you promised that you're going to do it once Brooke's out of the picture? Like, I just lost. And then when Brooke crawls all over him and he's asleep and he murmurs Allison's name, I was like, are you guys a thing? I was very confused about where their status was. And it, to the point where I was like, oh, they're just doing this so that Brooke can see them kissing. Like, it's not.
Yes.
Friends don't do that.
No, it's always confusing between the two of them. Like, the last time they kissed before this was when she was like, Haley was alive and they were still married. Like, they're just, there's a lot of the writing that depends on, like, they are soulmates in some way. Like, they're always going to be destined, which is like, they never earned it at all.
No. Not even a little. They don't have any chemistry.
No, never have. So that night, Billy yells up to Allison from the courtyard that they're going to miss their movie, but Allison doesn't know where Brooke is. And Jane and Jake, also going to this movie, join Billy in giving zero shits about Brooke's whereabouts. But as they're all heading out, Brooke returns drunk in our final clip.
Hi, everybody. Brooke. Going somewhere?
I was afraid you just picked up and left.
Afraid? You practically pushed me out the door. But I fooled you. I came back.
Looks like you're drunk.
No. I'm just doing my very best Allison impersonation. What do you think? Oh, Billy. Oh, you're the love of my life, no matter who you're married to.
Knock it off. Let's just go, okay?
Oh, yeah. Oh, go. Walk out on me. You're good at that. It's the one thing he is good at. I mean, in a sec.
Brooke, why don't I get you a cup of coffee?
Why don't you drop dead?
Allison, don't you dare help that little witch.
Ooh.
Let's go, Allison.
Good, go. Leave. Go on your little double date. How sweet.
two pea brains and a couple of sluts. Just leave. I'm used to being left behind my whole life. I'm used to no one caring. You hate me, don't you?
I don't even care enough about you to hate you. Now let go.
Fine, I'll say it! I hate you! You hear me? I hate you! Billy? Billy?
Shut up.
Do you hear me? I hate you!
That shut up is like Billy's season four character in a nutshell. He's so hateful.
Oh my God.
Two pea brains and a couple of sluts. Also a t-shirt, I think.
I laughed out loud multiple times at this. Like, she's so funny in this scene. And I feel like I was watching this and I was like, oh my God, I know she's about to die. Spoiler. And this is like devastating to me all of a sudden because drunk Brooke is hilarious.
Yes.
And Brooke going around screeching insults at all these ding-dongs at Mero's place is so satisfying.
Yeah. Only at the end did they like figure out her character, because there's so many points earlier in this season and season three where she's just so irritating and like you just don't understand why anyone would put up with her shit because she's such a chore. But this, you're so right. I mean, at one point she like makes a barf noise by like sticking her finger in her mouth.
It's so good.
While the movie crew walks out, they go right past a no lifeguard on duty sign, because this is the middle of the episode. And left alone, Brooke staggers around the courtyard sobbing. No one is home. Nobody cares. And then all of a sudden, she just randomly trips and falls into the pool, hitting her head on the edge before sinking down. And that's where we leave her, Brooke.
I gasped. I knew this. I mean, I watched this when it happened, and I've never forgotten it. I do remember being really shocked by it when it happened.
Yeah.
But even watching it this time, when she cracks her head, I did gasp.
Yeah.
I knew it was coming.
I knew she died, but I didn't realize it was an accident, I think.
Yes. I remember that part.
Oof.
Poor Brooke.
I just remember, like, I'm watching this GIF on the visual aids over and over again. And from the point at which the stunt person falls into the pool.
Yeah.
Where she's standing, she's clearly not tall enough to have actually hit her head on that side of the pool. So it's like she starts to go in and they have to quickly like get out of the danger, get out of what they've got themselves into by going to the close-up.
Mm-hmm.
You're like, oh yeah, she's going to be fine. She's going to land in the water. Oh no. No, she does not.
And that's it for our big fat double sweeps episode. Woo! What a journey.
Packed. Full of action.
Yeah.
Two people die. One concussion, a dance-a-thon. It truly has everything.
It does. Chris Davis, man. MVP. Ooh, I'm early.
No kidding. God, you're right. It is two people. I forgot about Vic. It was so long ago. Okay, so yes, let's close this up with our MVP. Heather, you already said.
Well, I think it probably was Kristen Davis. Like, she earned every Melrose paycheck just in this last 2 hours. She's every feeling on her face, every over... Honestly, everyone's earned all their money having to act opposite Andrew Hsu, who gives you nothing. Maybe it inspired some of her best work, because she was like, I have to put something into this scene because he's not doing anything. And her death was really, that was quite a way to go. Full marks for two pea brains and a couple of sluts. Perfectly delivered.
Jessica, who's your MVP for the episode?
I can't disagree with that, but the interest of picking someone else, I'm going to go with Laura Layton, who is like her most charming, funny self in this episode, even though she's really doing some crazy underhanded shit. And she's wearing, I mean, it's not a wig. She's got a terrible haircut. She is so likable, but she's like showing up with a cable box for no reason, really. Yep. Like, she's just like a pleasure and just a delight.
I agree with both of those choices, but just to be different, I'm going to say Peter, whose plan, as far as we can see, is going off without a hitch. I mean, he didn't actually get Sydney to sleep with Bobby, or rather Sydney didn't. But, if he's trying to sow seeds of suspicion between Amanda and Bobby, it's working. So good job. Least valuable player. Let's go to Jessica first this time.
Here's the thing. I want to pick Andrew Hsu because I think he's a terrible actor.
Yeah.
But he did incite a lot of emotion in me, mm-hmm. and that I really, 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 really hate Billy.
Yeah.
So I feel torn here. I mean, I guess I'm going to give it to him just because I think the way he's playing this is not adept.
Yeah.
From a technical acting standpoint, mm-hmm. but I do have to give him kind of like an asterisk for committing to whatever he was doing.
Okay, Heather.
I am going to go with John Enos III. Mm-hmm. I just cannot with Bobby Parisi. And I know I haven't recently seen his whole arc, but I find mm-hmm. him so flat and uncharismatic that I don't believe anyone would go to any of this trouble. I don't believe Amanda would like lay down for him. I don't believe that Peter would have to work that hard to get her away from him. Mm-hmm. And just every scene he's in, he gives the exact same amount of nothing.
Yeah.
No matter what they're talking about, like love, business, whatever. So for me, for sure him, and that probably could also retroactively apply as well.
I'm going to go with not Andrew Hsu, although fair, but Billy himself, because he's really, considering they are not even divorced yet, he's being extremely unfair and really putting Brooke's actual life and safety at risk by his actions, which are purely motivated out of spite and not thinking through how adults have to behave in the adult world of being adults.
Yeah, he sucks.
Yeah.
He's
and the I worst. Think you could give a tangential one, like a sub worst to Allison for that same reason.
Yes.
Because whilst her instincts are good, in the sense that she sort of tries to help.
Yeah.
She immediately rescinds every offer she makes. Like she's not consistent with any of it. And I think she's as much responsible for the whiplash that Brooke is feeling as, well, not as much, but she's certainly partly responsible for that.
Absolutely.
She should also just mind her own fucking business for 5 minutes, Allison Parker.
Yeah. Meet another guy. It's Los Angeles. Yeah. There's lots.
Or leave, just tell Billy, like, yeah, you know what? I'm going to let this poor girl stay with me for like 2 weeks and you're going to deal with it. And if you can't deal with it, I don't want to sleep with you anymore. Ever. Wasn't that good? Apparently, according to Brooke, it was finger gag to begin with.
Well, we did it. Next time,
yay!
Sarah will return. Matt continues trying to get Alan to choose between Matt and his career. Amanda's so desperate for another couple she and Bobby can have dinners with that she goes after Peter and Alicia. And Brooke may be dead, but that doesn't mean she's done with Billy. You can go to againwiththis90210.com to find more information about us and the podcast, including links to all our visual aids for our episodes. And I do mean all, because I cut 77 screenshots and GIFs for this episode. I am a psycho. You can also follow us on Twitter at AWT90210. I'm Tara Ariano. I'm on Twitter and Instagram at TaraArIano. My co-host is Sarah DeBunting. She's on Twitter at Tomato Nation. Our producer is David T. Cole. You can find him on Instagram at David T. Cole. And finally, thank you once again to our wonderful guest co-hosts, Heather Cox and Jessica Morgan. Please tell our listeners where they can find you online.
You can find us at our celebrity red carpet website, fashion website, Go Fug Yourself. That's a G. Get that hard G in there. GoFugYourself.com. We're back to real events now post-COVID, so there's a lot of fresh content on there.
Ooh. Also, we're on Twitter and Instagram at Fug Girls, F-U-G-G-I-R-L-S.
We will also link in the show notes to where people can buy your wonderful books, Royal We and the Air Affair, among others, on bookshop.org or at independent bookstores near you. That's it for us. We will see you next week.
I am so sorry all this is happening to you.